We're going to be in Genesis chapter 6. Actually, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 6 through chapter 9 this morning. We're going to move through that text. But we're to prepare ourselves for Christmas and that celebration. We're going to just be looking at different moments in history, in Israel's history, in biblical history, where we see the need, we see the necessity of the Messiah, of needing Christ, needing Him to come to help to solve. And so we are going to look this morning in the story of Noah. But before we get to the story of Noah, we've got to do a little background work. And so there's this book that we have that we've used for our kids, and it's pretty neat. It's called the Jesus Storybook Bible, and if you time it correctly and read it correctly at the right days, it is almost like an Advent calendar where you can read each day before Christmas until you get to Jesus' birth on the right day, and the whole book. The Jesus Storybook Bible is pointing towards Jesus' birth and then the salvation that Jesus offers through his death. And so I was going to read you a story this morning and give you a little bit of context for what were the verses that we're going to be studying, the passage we're going to be studying this morning in Genesis chapter 6. This is a paraphrase. This is not a direct word-for-word translation, but I think you'll get the gist of it. This is from the Bible, and it's just giving us a better understanding. I don't anticipate you can read that. Just imagine you're like that four-year-old that loves looking at the pictures as I read the story to you. But this is taken straight from Genesis chapter 1, or Genesis chapter 3, sorry. So this is called The Terrible Lie. Adam and Eve lived happily together in their beautiful new home, and everything was perfect for a while, until the day everything went wrong. God had a horrible enemy. His name was Satan. Satan had once been the most beautiful angel, but he didn't want to be just an angel. He wanted to be God. He grew proud and evil and full of hate, and God had to send him out of heaven. Satan was seething with anger and looking for a way to hurt God. He wanted to stop God's plan, stop his love story right there. So he disguised himself as a snake and waited in the garden. Now God had given Adam and Eve only one rule. Don't eat the fruit on that tree, God told them, because if you do, you'll think you know everything. You'll stop trusting me, and then death and sadness and tears will come. You see, God knew if they ate the fruit, they would think they didn't need him, and they would try to make themselves happy without him. But God knew there was no such thing as happiness without him, and life without him wouldn't be life at all. As soon as the snake saw his chance, he slithered silently up to Eve. Does God really love you? The servant whispered. If he does, why won't he let you eat that nice, juicy, delicious fruit? Poor you. Perhaps God doesn't want you to be happy. The snake's words hissed into her ears and sunk down deep into her heart like poison. Does God love me? Eve wondered. Suddenly, she didn't know anymore. Just trust me, the serpent whispered. You don't need God. One small taste, that's all, and you'll be happier than you could ever dream. Eve picked the fruit and ate some, and Adam ate some too, and a terrible lie came into the world. It would never leave. It would live on in every human heart, whispering to every one of God's children, God doesn't love me. And it wasn't a dream. It was a nightmare. A dove flew from Adam's hand. A deer darted into a thicket. It was as if they were frightened by something. A chill was in the air. Something strange was happening. They had always been naked, but now they felt naked and wrong. And they didn't want anyone to see them, so they hid. And later that evening, as God was taking his walk, he called to them, Children. Usually Adam and Eve loved to hear God's voice and would run to him. But this time they ran away from him and hid in the shadows. Where are you? God called. Hiding. Adam said, we're afraid of you. Did you eat the fruit I told you not to eat? God asked them. And Adam said, Eve made me do it. What have you done? God asked. And Eve said, the serpent made me do it. And terrible pain came into God's heart. His children hadn't just broken the one rule. They had broken God's heart. They had broken their wonderful relationship with him. And now he knew everything else would break. God's creation would start to unravel and come undone and go wrong. From now on, everything would die, even though it was all supposed to last forever. You see, sin had come into God's perfect world, and it would never leave. God's children would always be running away from him and hiding in the dark. Their hearts would break now and never work properly again. God couldn't let his children live forever, not in such pain, not without him. And there was only one way to protect them. "You'll have to leave the garden now," God told his children, his eyes filling with tears. "This is no longer your true home. It's not the place for you anymore." But before they left the garden, God made clothes for his children to cover them. And he gently clothed them, and then he sent them away on a long, long journey out of the garden, out of their home. In another story, it would have all be over, and that would have been the end. But not in this story. God loved his children too much to let the story end there. Even though he knew he would suffer, God had a plan, a magnificent dream. One day he would get his children back. One day he would make the world their perfect home again, and one day he would wipe away every tear from their eyes. You see, no matter what, in spite of everything, God would love his children with a never-stopping, never-giving-up, unbreaking, always and forever love. And though they would forget him and run from him, deep in their hearts, God's children would miss him always and long for him, lost children yearning for their home. Before they left the garden, God whispered a promise to Adam and Eve. "It will not always be so. I will come to rescue you. And when I do, I'm going to do battle against the snake. I'll get rid of the sin and the dark and the sadness you let in here. I'm coming back for you." And he would. One day, God himself would come. This was the burden of Adam and Eve. They had sinned. They had broken their relationship with God by choosing to not honor him, to not trust him, to not obey him. They embraced sin. Sin became a reality. And besides now being corrupted by sin, being unholy, being unacceptable in the presence of God, the punishment that came with it, with that reality, was harsh. Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 and 19, God is laying out the punishment here, and he says to the woman, "I will make your pains and childbearing very severe. With painful labor you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." And to Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return." And within that punishment, there are two parts that I want us to key in on this morning. Number one is that Eve will experience pain in childbearing and birth. "I'll make your pain in childbearing, and with painful labor you'll give birth." And it's important to know that Moses uses two different words for pain here in translating what God said. He uses a word for physical pain and he uses a word for emotional pain. There are going to be two kinds of pain for you in this childbirth, Eve. It is going to physically hurt, and emotionally it is going to hurt to raise and bear these children. And then the other thing that I want you to key in on here is that with this punishment, not only is there pain in childbearing and birth, but there's also death. "For dust you are, and to dust you return," which wasn't the way it was supposed to be. Because of their sin, they're going to die. And the storybook Bible paraphrases, their heart would never work properly again. God couldn't let his children live forever, not in such pain, not without him. And so there was only one way to protect them. Because of their sin, because they will die, then they're separated from God, removed from the paradise in the garden. And so there's going to be pain for Eve in childbirth, but also in childbearing. And then there's also going to be death, which wasn't supposed to be that way. But within the punishment, within God's curse, there is reason to hope. And we can see it when God turns his curse on Satan in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, just before Eve and just before Adam. He turns to Satan and he says, "I am going to put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel." And in that curse, there is hope, because God promises that Eve's offspring will crush Satan and Satan's offspring, sin. And again, the storybook that we read it paraphrases, he says, God whispers this promise to Adam and Eve, it will not always be so. I will come rescue you, and when I do, I'm going to battle against the snake. I'll get rid of the sin and the dark and the sadness you let in here. I'm coming back for you, and he would one day, God himself would come. And Adam and Eve understood, hearing this promise in the curse, that their offspring would be the sin crusher, that their offspring would be the one to restore what they broke. And so when their first son, Cain, is born, there is excitement. There's hope when Cain is born. You can see it in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, where Moses tells us that Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant, and she gave birth to Cain. And she said, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. And there in the fourth chapter, after the curse, Eve gives birth and she becomes a proud mother. And this must have been, if you can imagine, not too intently imagine, but if you can imagine this birth and this moment, this must have been an amazing experience to bring forth a human being similar to the way God brought forth a human being, right? Up until that point, God is the only one that has ever made man. And now Eve is giving birth, and the best way she can say it, she just says, I've made a human. I've made a man. And imagine that excitement as that process develops and she becomes the first woman to ever experience a baby bump. And maybe a little bit confused. Adam, do you think I've gained weight? Does this feel normal to you? This seems unusual to me. It looks like there's a basketball in my stomach, right? Maybe her confusion as Cain kicks her the first few times. What's going on? What is this? Right? Not understanding, like this has never happened before. Imagine what might be going through her mind with those first contractions. Like, oh no, I'm dying. Something wrong is happening. No, it's the right thing happening, right? And so her confusion, though, and what must be going through her mind in those moments, all of those 9 months and those five final moments would be beautiful. They'd be exciting, but also bittersweet because it hurts. It's hurting, right? There's pain. And when she goes into labor, it's not easy. It's painful. There's no epidurals. She's got to do this on her own. And I don't know how Adam figured out how to do like the delivery part of it. I'm assuming that came innately to him, or maybe God gave him some instructions before they left. He's like, hey, just so you know, this is coming. And when it does, you're going to want to cut that thing and just detach them from like the mom, right? I don't know how he learned that, but they did, yeah? But imagine like there's this excitement along with the pain, along with the hurt. There's that reminder, because it's not easy, that Adam and Eve sinned. The reason this hurts is because we messed up, but then there's hope. And the way it reads in our text when we read Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, it doesn't come across as enthusiastic than Eve expressed it. I've brought forth a man. I have an offspring. In the birth of Cain, there's hope for Eve. Because the mistakes that Adam and Eve made, their sin, they're probably thinking, that sin, those mistakes, that brokenness, that's ours to bear. Those are our consequences. We messed up. But now they have a son. Right? And God said, their offspring would crush and defeat Satan and sin. He would defeat the source and the cause of the situation that they find themselves in. The sin crusher is here. We have our offspring. We have our hope. We have the one that's going to undo what we broke, we messed up, but we have brought forth the offspring. And in Cain, there's hope. You know the story, right? Cain wasn't it. It was a misplaced hope. Because in Cain, inside Cain, there was sin and death. And here's the emotional pain of Eve's childbearing. Sin isn't just an Adam and Eve problem. Sin isn't just an Adam and Eve consequence. It's been passed on. Cain has it too. It's going to be an everyone problem and an everyone consequence. And Paul, when he writes years and years later, recognizes this. And when he writes to the Roman Christians, he says things like this. In Romans chapter 5, some of verse 12 and 18 and 19, he says, what we know now is that sin entered the world through one man, and along with it, death. And in this way, death came to all people because we all sin. And he says this, he says that one trespass, one mistake, one disobedience resulted in condemnation for everyone. And he says this too. He says, through the disobedience of the one man, the rest of us, we were all made sinners. Because of Adam, we are dead men walking. Because of Adam, we are condemned. Because of Adam, we're sinners. Because of Adam and Eve, we all need a sin crusher. We all need Eve's offspring to defeat Satan and sin, and it wasn't Cain. Cain was full of sin, and Cain caused death. And imagine the pain in childbearing, knowing that not only did you break your own relationship with God, you broke your son, you broke his brother, and everyone that follows after it. You've broken humanity. Adam and Eve have more sons and daughters, and there's, with each birth, there's always that possibility, right? Maybe this son is the offspring. Maybe this one is the sin crusher, right? The authors of the Bible give us their family tree. Seth is the next born of Adam and Eve, but it's not Seth. Seth has sons, and even though those sons and Seth's family lived with a belief in God, it wasn't any of them. If that genealogy tells us anything, it's that they all die. They're not the one. In generation after generation of Eve's offspring come, but it's none of them. And if you read the genealogy of Adam's birth in Genesis, in Genesis 5, there's a pattern of he lived, he gave birth, or he had a son and then he died. He lived, he had a son, and he died, and he died, and he died over and over and over again. And then 9 generations later, that pattern, he had a son and then he died, is interrupted about 1,000 years after Adam. 9 generations of hoping for the sin crusher, 9 generations of living with the consequences of sin, for 1,000 years seeing this brokenness spread for person after person after person after person. Lamech becomes the father of Noah in Genesis chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. The genealogy changes. It doesn't say when he had lived, he became the father, and after he became the father, he lived and then died. Verse 28 of Genesis chapter 5 says, when Lamech had lived 182 years, he had a son. He named him Noah. But there's more. Because he said, he will comfort us in the labor and the painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed. Well, that's new. Because that's not how everybody else was described. Everybody else was born, had a name, lived, and died. But in Noah, the story is different. This birth was different. It doesn't fit the formula. There are extra details added, something that Noah's father said, and we're supposed to draw our attention to it because it's different than all the rest. Back to the tension of his birth and remove us from the repetitiveness of that death cycle, Lamech names his son Comfort. And he says he will comfort us in the labor and painful toil caused by the curse. And this expression sounds a lot like the hope Eve had for Cain. Lamech says his son will bring comfort to the consequences of sin. His description, what he says, is part of the curse, right? It's part of Adam's curse. Adam was cursed to have painful toil and labor over the ground just to eat and survive. And Lamech says, this boy is going to comfort us in our labor and toil. There's hope here. This is different. And as we read, if this is our first time reading this account, we're meant to be asking, is this him? Is this the sin crusher? Is this the one that they've been hoping for? The offspring that's supposed to come, is this the son? So we read his story and Noah's account, and things are bad. Things are bad as Noah grows up and gets older. But in Noah, there is hope. If you look at Genesis chapter 6, we're going to begin in verse 5. The Lord saw, this is in Noah's time, how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And the Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. And so the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So this is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. And Noah had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence, and God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. And so we see here in this description of Noah's day, a world that is fully in the throes of the curse, fully engulfed in the consequences of sin. Creation had been corrupted. Creation had been ruined and spoiled. What God had made good had become cruel. Violence was everywhere. Nature was violent against man. Man was violent against man. Man was violent against nature. That's the description he's giving us beginning in verse 5. There is violence between and among and in everything on earth. Right? The ways of men had been ruined, corrupted. The design of God was spoiled. This was, that description, if you compare it to the garden, it is far, far, far away. They have traveled far from the Garden of Eden. God's creation was broken. People were so broken by sin that the intellect that God had gifted them with was used in complete opposition to God's design. In verse 5 of chapter 6, they're using the intellect that God gave them, but instead, every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. People were broken. Everything the mind purposed was evil, was bad. And this caused God great sorrow and deep regret. And so he resolved to drastically end the rampant chaos and the corruption of sin. Humanity and earth will be destroyed. He says in verse 13 of chapter 6, God says to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people. For the earth is filled with violence because of people. I'm surely going to destroy both them and the earth. And then 17, he explains how. He says, I'm going to bring floodwaters on the earth. It's going to destroy all life under the heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. So God chooses to start over. And to start over, he chooses Noah in verse 18. Everything on earth will perish, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you will enter the ark, and you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. I'm going to save you, Noah. But why Noah? Compared to the rest of humanity, what we learn is that he was relatively holy. That's what verse 9 tells us, right? That Noah, this is his account, he was a righteous man. He was blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. He was righteous and blameless among the people, right? And that clarifier is important to keep in mind. You compare him to everybody else, and he was holy. He was righteous. And that's demonstrated by a life spent living in submission to the one God, right? He lived actively, faithfully to the worship, out of his worship of God, right? The one God, right? He was the only God. And so because Noah lived out of that fear of God, he found God's favor, he enjoyed God's grace, and he was about to experience God's salvation because of it. Based on his obedience and faith, he's going to obey God, and God is going to tell him a big ask, and he said, you need to obey. You're going to have to take it's going to take some faith to do this, to build a boat in the desert, but out of that faith will come salvation and restart the humanity as one who walks faithfully with God was Noah's task. God chose the one who was most faithful to him and said, you're going to restart. We're going to restart and reset humanity out of the family who worships God. And so again, this is the question. This is the question. If this is our first time reading through Genesis, this is the question. Is it Noah? Is Noah the comforter? There was a difference in his genealogy, and he's called the one who's going to end our labor and our toil. He's going to address part of the curse. Is he the offspring? Is he the sin crusher? Was Lamech right? Is this it? Is this the moment? Is he so righteous and blameless that this restart will restore humanity through Noah? 9 generations after Eve, is it finally here? And so Noah obeys in faith. Right? And familiar with the story, the flood comes. This is from Genesis chapter 7, verse 11 to 8, verse 14. The flood comes, right? And it floods for 150 days. The floodwaters rise for 150 days and dramatically reshapes the earth. And a year after it started, the cataclysm is over and the survivors finally leave the ark. After a year on this ship, they leave having been saved by Noah's faith. Right? The faith that said, even though I've never seen rain, I've never seen a flood, and we live in a desert, I'm going to choose to obey God and build this boat. And they enter into a new world, a world that has been purged of the deep corruption of sin and everything that it twisted. It's all gone. Everyone corrupted by sin is gone. Everything corrupted by sin is gone. And the first thing that Noah does in chapter 8, if you want to look at verse 18, The very first thing that Noah does after a year on a ship, after the earth is dramatically reshaped, after he has been saved by faith in God, in chapter 8, verse 18, the first thing that Noah does is worship God. Noah comes out of the ship together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. All the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds, everything that moves on land came out of the ark, one kind after another. And then Noah built an altar to the Lord. And taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. And the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma of worship. This worship is sweet. Moses tells us it's that pleasing aroma to God. And it causes, if you keep reading, a response in God's heart that is a 180 degree change from where he was prior to the flood. Prior to the flood, God was ready to just wipe everyone, and he did, and he's going to. But this human, Noah, and his worship, and his words, his actions are so much more positive and satisfying, and God says, we're not doing this again. As Noah worships, for the reader, as we read through this story, you have to be becoming more convinced. There is hope. This is the reset. The first thing the new human race does is worship God, is celebrate God and his salvation, right? This is hopeful. This has to be the new beginning, the restart, right? With the worship of God, and we have to be asking the question, has sin been crushed? Has sin been crushed? Is Noah the one? Seems like maybe he is. Look at chapter 9, verse 20. This is sometime after they've started to create the life for themselves. He's a man of the soil, and he should be, because that's how they have to live now. But Noah was a man of the soil. He proceeded to plant a vineyard. And notice the, I want you to notice the parallel here. There's a fruit here that's a problem. And it's the enjoying of the fruit here that's going to be a problem. And there is a parallel between this and the creation story. It's the fruit. And so he planted a vineyard. And when he drank some of its wine, he became drunk, and he lay uncovered inside his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders, and then they walked in backward, and they covered their father's naked body, and their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father naked. And when Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." And he goes on to bless the other two brothers. But Noah doesn't make a good choice with the fruit of his labor. And whether this is fully sin in the text isn't clear. It's not meant to be the emphasis of the text that the major issue is Noah getting drunk. It is an issue. It's a problem, obviously. It's a problem and a sin, as we learn later on. But that's not the focus of the text. The emphasis is on Ham, his son. Because Noah was righteous and blameless, and we're supposed to remember that as we go through. He's righteous and blameless of the people of his time, right? Adam and Eve had a problem, and it was their curse, but what about their son? And so we're not supposed to focus quite on Noah. He's the comforter, right? He's the one that's supposed to deal with the curse. He should deal with the curse. There's hope there, but his son Ham, whatever it is that he does in this moment, and there's a lot of debate about what he does, it's unclear, but whatever he does isn't good. It isn't righteous. It isn't godly. It's sinful. It's sin. And all that hope of the sin crusher comes crashing down. It's still here. After all of that, at that salvation on the ark, choosing the most righteous and blameless man, there is still sin inside them. Sin is in the family. Even the most righteous man on earth wasn't blameless enough, couldn't end sin by sheer willpower, followed by generations of non-sinners. He can't do it. The most blameless man among people couldn't crush sin, couldn't give us the restart that we needed. And to punctuate it, Noah's story ends in verse 28. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. He lived a total of 950 years. And then he died. It wasn't him. He wasn't the sin crusher. He wasn't the offspring, the one that would deal with sin and death and give victory. His story ends with his son, full of sin, being cursed. His son being cursed, just like the first story. So what can be our takeaways since Noah wasn't him? Noah wasn't the one. I think the first takeaway is that sin is not so easily crushed. Sin is a problem for everyone, and it cannot be dealt with by just anyone. This is our first takeaway from the fact that Noah wasn't the offspring. Noah wasn't the sin crusher. It wasn't him. Sin is a problem for everyone, and it cannot be dealt with by just anyone. Man can't simply be righteous enough in himself to counteract, to mitigate, to end their problem with sin. You can't be blameless enough. You could be the most blameless among everybody else. You could be the one that God chose to restart with decent human beings, but being decent enough isn't enough. Sin is a problem for everyone, and it can't be dealt with by just anyone. You can't be good enough. You can't do good enough things. You can't make as little mistakes as possible and achieve victory over sin. No one has done that. Noah couldn't do it. Seth couldn't do it. Cain didn't do it. I know this because they all died. And if sin was truly dealt with and addressed in your life, then the consequences of death wouldn't be yours to pay. But the truth is, just like in Noah, there is always sin inside, and that corruption deserves death. That corruption deserves punishment, and you can't do the saving yourself. If Noah wasn't good enough, you aren't good enough to end sin. If Noah wasn't good enough, then you are not good enough to end sin. Noah wasn't holy, you aren't holy, and you can't be holy. You may be a good person, you may live a relatively blameless life, but you can't perfectly separate yourself from sin and then just stop sinning. Sin is inside you. Sin is in there and it is corrupting you. You can't end your own sin, let alone the sin of others, because you're just not good enough. And this is a lesson that we take from Noah. Sin's a problem for everyone. It can't be dealt with by just anyone, and you, take this personally, are not good enough to end sin for you or anyone else. But God promised he would do it, that there would be an offspring that would crush Satan and sin, and it wasn't Noah, and it isn't you. Sin is a problem for everyone. It is not so easily crushed by simply being righteous enough yourself. And if you think that it is, then it's a lie that you're going to believe to your grave. If you think that you can be good enough to deal with your sin problem, you will take that lie to your grave. But the second takeaway from Noah not being the one is that God made this very clear. Sin must be dealt with. Sin will be dealt with. Sin will be defeated. God will do that through the offspring. That much is clear. He's going to deal with sin. He promised he would deal with sin, and he's going to do it through the offspring. But faith is what will be rewarded with salvation. That much we see in Noah's story. Faith is what will be rewarded. There's no other way, no matter how righteous you are, to find that salvation through the offspring, but by faith. Even the most righteous person in the world was saved only by his faith. You're not good enough. Only the offspring is going to be able to do that. And your salvation through that offspring, through that one, is only going to be through faith. Even the most righteous person in the world was only saved by his faith. Noah's an example of that for us to visualize it. Noah was saved not because he was blameless, right? But because he believed in God and he believed God. Right, he was saved by his faith, which caused him to do the illogical and build a boat in the middle of a desert, anticipating rain and a flood when it's never done that before. And Peter tells us in the New Testament that Noah's story is a picture of salvation. And the author of Hebrews comments on this in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 7. He says that by faith, Noah, when he was warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, in faith, built an ark to save his family. And by his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that is in keeping with faith. He was saved when the rest of the world was condemned, not because he was blameless, because he had faith. He was saved by faith. And this is the profound truth of the battle against Satan and sin. The battle to save you from sin isn't yours to win. It's yours to believe that your salvation was won for you by the sin crusher. It is not your battle to win. It's yours to believe that it was won by the sin crusher. And this is the lesson of Noah, that Noah isn't him. Sin is a problem for you, and you're not good enough to deal with it. The most righteous man in the world wasn't good enough to deal with it. Your righteousness, your good enough, won't save you from your sin. Even the most righteous person in the world was saved by faith. And your faith in the sin crusher, in the offspring, in Jesus Christ the Messiah, that will save you. Not in yourself. It has to be in Christ. I want to turn our attention to, with that in mind, to communion, to reflecting on that sacrifice. It's not a mystery in this room who the sin crusher is. We don't have to wait in anticipation to find out, like the original readers of history, the Jews, as they were clued into the fact that it wasn't Noah, it wasn't others, but it was in fact Jesus. That's not a mystery to us. We know that. And we take communion to remember the chosen one, to remember the offspring, to remember God himself, God come to do battle against the snake, to get rid of sin and the darkness and the sadness caused by Adam and Eve's brokenness, God coming back for us, God not abandoning us, God coming to rescue us as a sin crusher. So I want you just to take a brief moment and reflect on that profound love when Jesus tells Adam and Eve, come back, I will be back. The storybook Bible calls this his love, God's never stopping, never giving up, unbreaking, always and forever love for his children, for his creation. Reflect on that love, that God loved you that much. This bread, you can take your bread. This bread represents the broken body of the sin crusher. Satan struck Jesus' heel as God said he would. He caused Jesus the pain of death. But it was only a bite on the heel. It wasn't mortal. It wasn't victory. It was a parting shot as he was being crushed. And that reality where Satan thought he was giving a mortal wound in the death of Jesus, not realizing that it was actually just the fang in the heel as his head was being crushed, causes Paul to almost taunt in 1 Corinthians, where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Where's your sting? And the night before he died, Jesus held this bread, like we all do now, holding our own portion of it, and he used it to remind his followers that Satan was about to strike the heel, but it wasn't going to be a victory, because death was about to be defeated by Christ's sacrifice of himself, the only sinless one on behalf of the unrighteous. And he would break the power of the one who holds the power of death. And so we do this in remembrance of the night that Jesus' heel was struck. Do this in remembrance. And you can take your juice. This juice represents the life of Jesus, life offered to us through his sacrifice, a life freed from the slavery of sin, salvation offered to us by his blood. Satan struck Jesus' heel, but Jesus crushed Satan's head and defeated him and his offspring, sin, just as God said he would. Jesus traded death for life and freed all those who were held in slavery by their fear of death, their inability to overcome their sin, our inability to overcome the consequences of sin. Jesus offers freedom and life, which are ours by faith. Salvation from sin is only yours through faith, not in yourself, but faith in the sin crusher. The night before he was sacrificed, Jesus held his wine, this juice, and he used it to remind his followers that life and salvation can be ours through faith. And so we do this in remembrance and out of faith in the night that Jesus crushed Satan, sin, and death. Do this in remembrance.